Hi, I'm James.
And I'm Anthony.
And this is Words and Numbers. I have a Words and Numbers t-shirt, and I wear it out in public from time to time, but nobody has ever stopped me to say, hey, what's that? And I'm a little disappointed, truth be told.
I know. I have a mask that says Words and Numbers. I was always hoping someone would say, oh yeah, I listen to them.
Well, we're going to have to get a lot more popular, I guess, which means everyone listening has to send this podcast to at least two of their friends. Let me walk that back. I know most of you don't have two friends.
Send it to random people.
Send it to two people that you know. So we get to the pain point pretty quickly. What's new and exciting in your world this week, Ant?
The thing economists most love to talk about are unintended consequences, because they're stories, people love stories, and they beautifully illustrate the core principle of economics, that people respond to incentives. In past episodes and in our book, Cooperation and Coercion, we talk about all sorts of unintended consequences, from pollution laws that make pollution worse to laws intended to help the poor that, in fact, harm the poor. I ran across another interesting story of unintended consequences, that flying spy missions increase the mosquito population.
What the hell?
There's this plane, the SR-71 Blackbird, that if you saw it, you'd recognize it. This was a spy plane principally used to take aerial photographs of sensitive targets. It was, and I think still is, the fastest plane ever produced. It flew in excess of Mach 3, which is so fast that it actually didn't need defensive weapons. It simply outran whatever missiles were launched at it. The problem is that it could go so fast that air friction would cause the plane to glow red. To deal with the high heat from air friction, the plane required special metals and special fuel. The special fuel, called JP7, was formulated to withstand the high temperatures without breaking down chemically. In the 1950s, Shell Oil produced this fuel for the Air Force, but the fuel required an ingredient that Shell normally used to make mosquito repellent. The result was, as the Air Force required more and more fuel for the SR-71s, there developed a nationwide shortage of mosquito repellent, and so an increase in the mosquito population. Now, mosquitoes are responsible for killing more humans than any other animal on the planet, this through the transmission of malaria. Fortunately, malaria is rare in the United States. Otherwise, this story of unintended consequences would have ended quite badly.
Well, as luck would have it, I have a partial solution to the problem of malaria here in the United States, should it ever come along. The nice people over at Amazon have succeeded in making it possible for the dead to speak to the living. They have what we might call a deep fake version for voice. All they need is a 1 minute sound clip from anyone to have a voice map made and working within minutes.
That's interesting. You just put a bunch of voice actors out of business.
There is that, but as the article that I read this morning indicates, what this means is that dead grandma can come by and read a story to the kids to put them to bed.
Right.
And it just gets creepier and creepier from there. If you think about all of the crackpot things you could do if you just had 1 minute's worth of another person's voice. And let's be honest, we have that for millions, if not billions of people at this
right.
point.
Yeah, just go on YouTube or TikTok.
This is going to get very confusing. Which brings us to the foolishness of the week. There were a couple of contenders here. Coming in at a pretty close second was an article in The New Yorker where Donald Trump was berating the many generals in his orbit, asking them why he couldn't have generals like Adolf Hitler had, which I think is just a bit much. One of these generals pointed out that Hitler's generals on three separate occasions tried to kill him and right. actually came pretty close one time. Trump responded, "No, they didn't," and just moved on. Right? But here we are. The article was surrounding his desire to have a military parade in D.C., complete
right.
with tanks rolling up the streets.
Yeah.
Some of his friends pointed out that this was only going to ruin the streets, and maybe we shouldn't do this on pragmatic grounds, and then maybe we shouldn't do it on principled grounds, because the only reason people ever do this is to show the great unwashed how powerless they are. This is like foolishness of the week 1B. But Ant, there is such a clear winner this week. I don't know if I should say that the IRS has won. I don't know if I should say that the American people has won the foolishness of the week, right? Something that you really should not aim to win. But we had this lottery a week or so ago.
Yeah, it was like $1 billion.
Over $1 billion.
Yeah.
Now, we often say, correctly, that a lottery like this is a tax against people who are bad at math.
Yeah.
But when it gets up over $1 billion, I think actually the math works out that you should play. The chances of winning are better than one in a billion. So dutifully, I walked off and I bought myself some lottery tickets. And I only buy these things to enjoy thinking about what might happen were I to win. I know I'm not going to win. That's not the point. The point is that I like dreaming about it. I'm paying a couple of dollars for a daydream. And the daydreams are so fantastically wonderful that they're worth more than $2. So there I am, kind of walking around, thinking myself, even before the numbers are drawn, I know I've won because I'm so happy. But who really wins the lottery? The correct answer here is the IRS.
Right.
Because the dude who won, what was it, $1.2 billion, is going to walk away with about $400 million.
Yeah.
The IRS gets all the rest.
Yeah.
So even if you win the lottery, the government gets 2/3 of what you should have gotten all for yourself. I don't know a better advertisement for the point of view that we bring to the table, that government is everywhere and always the problem. Even if you win the lottery, the government's going to get more than you do. Chew on that a little bit.
To get more Ant and James, buy a copy of our excellent book, Cooperation and Coercion. You can find the paper and electronic versions on Amazon and the audio version on Audible. If you'd like to support Words and Numbers, make your way over to patreon.com/wordsandnumbers, where you can contribute to our podcast-making habits. If you'd like to schedule us to come speak at your event, be it corporate or educational, or have James officiate at your wedding, send us an email at wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com. Phil Magnus is Director of Research and Education at the American Institute for Economic Research and a research fellow at the Independent Institute. Phil's research specialties include the economic history of the United States, the economic dimensions of slavery and racial discrimination, and the histories of taxation and economic inequality. In addition to prodigious research output, he has written for the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Newsweek, Politico, Reason, and National Review. Phil, welcome back to Words and Numbers.
It's been a real long time, hasn't it, Phil?
It has.
We should probably tell the people that we work together again.
Yeah.
We're getting used to yelling at each other all the time.
Well, thank God you've got somebody else to yell at.
That's right.
We had Rob McDonald on a couple of episodes ago talking about the founding just in time for 4th of July. And he said something that got me thinking that we should have you on because you'd be good to address this question. Rob makes this argument that at the founding, England had already declared us by their actions as independent, in that the king, the parliament, were no longer acting toward us as a government should. And so you have the founders in this country saying, look, these colonies are and by right ought to be free and independent states. The whole mindset was secession from England is logical, it's right, it's proper. And then less than 100 years later, we have the federal government saying to the southern states, no, it is not fitting and proper that you secede. How do you balance those two things?
Well, it's a tricky one. I think the first and most obvious thing that we need to get on the table is that the southern secession movement is premised upon a very immoral cause. It's the cause of preserving and protecting slavery. And they're very explicit about that in the reasons that they decide to secede. That is hanging over any of the philosophical arguments about self-determination and self-government. Yet at the same time, they are very consciously aware of their own position in relation to what happened in 1776. And they draw that analogy. They try to play it up. So there's a real tension between a difference of causes for the reasons that induce them to try to separate, but also a philosophical appeal to self-governance and charting your own course. And that really collides in ways that are not pleasant to think about and work through, mainly because they play out on the battlefield.
Okay, but I got to push back there, because in the North, the claim was that slavery is not a legitimate claim for secession. And
right.
We as modern people can agree with that. However, in the minds of the leaders in the South, yes, this was a legitimate cause for secession. And you could make the same argument going back to 1776, where England would say, well, divine right of kings. Of course you don't have a right to secession.
But I'm going to push back even on you now. Because of course I am. If you follow the logic of the Declaration of Independence, clearly the South should be permitted, if you want to use those terms. Secession is legitimate for any reason they decide. They don't have to decide why. They don't have to make that argument. Now, Jefferson in the Declaration does make that argument. The Declaration is written for the world to read and understand. But that was not necessary. He did it, but he didn't have to.
It's fair.
When all three of us shrug our shoulders, that's a pretty good indication that there are a lot of answers here, but no one universally accepted correct answer here.
Yeah.
When we look back at this period and we understand that it was within 100 years that the bloodiest war in all of human history to that point was being fought between and among Americans in the Civil War, what are we saying now when we're hearing the idea of secession where certain municipalities want to secede and join other states? And then at the state level, where we find that maybe some states, looking at you, California, might want to secede. And what would be the correct answer?
Very tricky questions, because there's no clear constitutional mechanism for this. There are philosophical mechanisms. And that's the great debate that played out in 1860-61. On top of the complexities of the slavery issue, on top of everything involved there, is this a mechanism that is permitted under the Constitution, or is the Union a perpetual entity?
And Lincoln had very clear thoughts on the matter.
That he did. I'm not sure I fully agree with him on the perpetuity, but I can see where he's coming from.
Explain that a little bit.
It's the notion that when the United States bound together as a compact, in some sense, that does predate the Declaration of Independence itself. And the question here is whether the states are acting independently and all acceding to a Declaration of Independence jointly, if they're acting as state actors, or are they acting as a unit? Hmm. It's a legal ambiguity. I think Lincoln makes the argument that really the acts of union come from the creation of the Continental Congress over a year before they pull the trigger and depart from Great Britain. Whereas on the southern side, they make the argument these are individual states coming together and acting as states in succession with each other.
The state's angle plays. When you look at the Declaration, we end with the idea of statehood. When we look at the Constitution, statehood ripples throughout every other word. But I want to read out loud Jefferson's words from the Declaration. He writes, "Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles or as power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." So government exists to secure your rights. If it doesn't do that, go ahead and replace it with one that will be most likely to affect your safety and happiness. That all seems very clear to me. And of course, it seems clear when you're talking about secession in 1776, because that was the plan. We were going to secede. When you get to secession in 1860 or so, somehow all the rules have changed.
There's another layer of complexity there. How do you get to decide which governing entity makes that call?
From Jefferson's words, it seemed to me to be none of
right.
That the people acting as a people would somehow have to make that point known. I'm not sure how they would do that.
You throw another layer of complexity onto that. What do you do in some of the deep South states? More than 50% of the population is enslaved.
Yeah. And then what do you do in some of those states where secession is clearly what they want, but not in others?
Exactly. There are states of the Confederacy that are on the border that are split. They have divided populations. There are states in the Deep South that are hardcore committed to the idea from the moment Lincoln's elected. And there's quite a bit of a gradient even within the Confederacy about levels of commitment to this cause of independence. Some of the border states, you find areas and regions of them, counties of them, that are basically dragged along because the political center of the state, located elsewhere, decided to go full in on secession.
You mentioned this a little while ago, but people who define themselves as classical liberals or libertarians, maybe, look at Abraham Lincoln and don't quite know what to make of it.
That is exactly the case.
These people aren't exactly in that Lincoln worshiping cult that comes out of, say, where I once lived. Claremont, California, or any of these sorts of places. But here's the thing. If you laid out for me every single detail and said, okay, James, you're president, what do you do? I might do exactly what Lincoln did. I really think I might have done what Lincoln did for exactly the reason you gave earlier. What do you do about slavery?
Right.
Is that something that you're willing just to jettison as an issue and say, well, you guys figure it out down in the South? And I don't know that I could have come to that conclusion. It's messy. There are levels of confounding ideas, but I don't want to push for what we're supposed to do now.
Well, there's the complexity of it. I mean, it's revisiting founding philosophical debates.
Yeah, debates that we all thought were closed.
Yeah.
What do we make of municipalities that want to jump to a different state, but their actual state doesn't want to let that happen? Whose will becomes important?
Yeah.
And I don't know that there's a right answer.
We have a very clunky constitutional mechanism for that type of a situation, because the creation of new states or the separation of new states requires an assent. There's really only one point in history when we had a clear exercise of that clause in a way that follows it to the letter, and it was extremely messy. It's in the middle of the Civil War when West Virginia breaks away from Virginia. You have counties out in the West that were not committed to this cause of secessionism. In many cases, they were poorer counties. They were more rural. Some of them are mountainous. They had no political connection to the power elite in Richmond. So they really see themselves as not part of the representative government that is purporting to act on their behalf. And then to add fuel to that fire, Confederacy institutes a draft. They send draft recruiters going around to these counties and basically drawing people off of their farms and say, you must fight in the war. That's going to make it really unpopular quickly. So what do? West Virginia effectively secedes from Virginia and applies for statehood. And because the two seats from Virginia in the U.S. Senate had basically been abandoned, what the Union government did is it recognized two replacement senators out of West Virginia as the senators for Virginia, and they voted to partition Virginia. So,
having lived in West Virginia, it always struck me as odd that they took the name West Virginia rather than claiming that they are Virginia.
Oh, exactly.
The rest of it is East Virginia. They're the ones that seceded.
That's effectively it. They had a moment where they were calling themselves the Restored Government of Virginia.
That's a bit of a mouthful.
And I think they were operating out of Wheeling, which is up on the panhandle of West Virginia, very far removed from Richmond, but they were acting, at least as far as the legal authorities of the United States government were concerned, as the government of Virginia.
That's actually a hoot.
Yeah.
I've already thrown California on the table, but I think we have at least three states that would likely prefer to be countries.
Yep.
You're right.
I'm thinking California, Utah, and Texas.
Right. Mm-hmm.
For very different reasons, but for very clear reasons, I know for a fact there are a number of people in these states that would absolutely want this to happen. In Utah, they've already drafted a document for a shadow government. Everybody knows what's going to happen when they become independent. This is in their field of vision more than you might think.
These are states that have histories of independent streaks to them.
Yep.
Before they entered into the Union, Texas is an independent republic. Utah, they're never quite sure what to make of it, but it does try to strike itself out as entity on itself and goes to war with the U.S. government at some points over territory.
It's absolutely a Mormon state, and that defines their thinking politically. I think if you had a ballot measure, should we secede or stay in Utah, that would be a lot closer than people think. And so too Texas, I think.
Yep.
California is kind of the holdout amongst those three. I get the sense that you do, James, that California would rather be unto itself, except that many people I talk to who live there, when I ask about this, they say, oh no, California really is three separate states. It should be three rather than one.
I think that's a relic of history. The fact that it entered the Union as a very, very large swath of territory that at the time was sparsely populated.
You can add three states from California right now if you did it well, which would actually maintain the balance of power in the Senate. And then you would have to admit that, okay, whatever happens moving forward is what happens. But I think you could set things up in such a way that it wouldn't upset the apple cart too terribly much, Southern California, Northern California, and Orange County. Look, I live in Arizona, the last of the lower 48 to be admitted into the Union, and we are being flooded with Californians.
Yes.
They come here, and they come into our most expensive housing markets, and they look at the prices, and they say, wow, that's cheap. and they buy things, and then they demand that we all acquiesce to their version of politics, which is what drove them out of California in the first place.
Self-replication.
Yep, that's right.
Going back to the opening question of how do we reconcile these two different views on secession in the founding, it's a good idea, and the Civil War, it's a bad idea. Are we left simply with the premise that might makes right?
I think that's the de facto outcome, but with a caveat there that they did settle the slavery question in what was ultimately the moral direction, ultimately the answer that we would hope for. But the question there is whether that is an intentional design or just a consequence. And I think most of the evidence points toward it being not purely an accident, but a consequence that comes about almost entirely because of the events that allowed it to unfold that way.
It's interesting you go down that path, because I've heard people argue on both sides of what I'm about to say, that Lincoln's primary concern was keeping the Union together, and whether slavery came or went was secondary to that. And that I've heard other people say, no, eradicating the slavery was the primary. What's your view on that?
Well, as a political objective, he states outright that his primary objective is keeping the Union together with slaves or without slaves. It's the famous letter he writes to Horace Greeley of the New York Tribune when he's posed with stating the cause of the war. But at the same time, he does move against slavery when the events around him permit him to do so. And this starts even really early in the war. It's May of 1861, at the very outbreak of the war, when some slaves escape across the Union lines into Fort Monroe, Virginia. They're fleeing the Confederacy for very obvious reasons. They think they can get to the Union lines, they get their freedom, but the Union Army has no idea what to do with them. Hmm. There's a refugee crisis that's showing up at this one Union-held outpost on the end of a peninsula in Virginia. And the way they resolve it is they look at the law and they say, well, the law of war permits armies to seize the contraband of their opposing army. And the Confederacy considers these slaves as property of the army. We are seizing them as contraband, and they give them their freedom.
So the Northern Army says, okay, South, you're right. They are property after
all. Exactly. Right. Kind of uses their own argument against them. And then, by the way, we'll free them. Of course, they freed them, and then they draft them. Eventually, they start drafting them into the Union Army, or really heavily pressuring them to join the Union Army. And that's, again, another mixed bag in itself. But it is a classic case of the Lincoln administration pushing against slavery when and where it can without making that the primary cause of the war. A little bit later on, as we start approaching the Emancipation Proclamation, which comes about as a military measure, but it's a derivative of this contrabands policy. Originally, they codify that into laws, and part of the provisions of those laws allow Lincoln, at least in the military zones of the war, to act in certain ways in how he determines military property or the property that's claimed by the South can be used, including the slaves. And when the window opens for him to issue a proclamation of emancipation, he does exactly that.
And the hilarious part is that didn't free a single slave.
And that was the quip that the British minister to the United States said back to his government, Lord Lyons. He says, well, Lincoln freed every slave in the territory that he doesn't have the power to free them. But it changes the dynamic of the war, because what do we know about wars? Military lines shift daily.
Right.
And especially when you have campaigns being waged and armies moving across territory, maybe it doesn't free slaves now, but next week the Union Army advances 100 miles inland. What do you have? Suddenly a new territory of South Carolina is under Union control, and there's an impetus now to free the slaves.
It certainly changed the way we look at things, because the residue of the Emancipation Proclamation, I feel it now. People refer to it all the time.
Absolutely.
They might not actually know the interior contours of the Emancipation Proclamation, but they certainly understand the spirit of it.
Yeah.
And that defines a lot of what we talk about with each other even now.
And it was recognized at the moment it was issued, not in Washington, D.C., you know, Washington, D.C., it's a very dry, lawyerly town. They sign the proclamation. They go through the motions. It reads like a legislative bill. When the news of it arrives on the ground, on the beaches in South Carolina, where the Union has established its army, has established kind of a beachhead to start moving into the state, and they're recruiting African-American slaves that are freed by the proclamation to join the United States Colored Troops, which is a part of the measure that's created in the wake of the proclamation. But we have accounts down there as they're reading the announcement that the proclamation has been signed. It's emotionally overwhelming to everyone that's there on site. They know that this is the end of slavery.
I have to tell you that had I been a slave at that time, I couldn't wait to put a uniform on and go shoot people that used to enslave
right.
me. Right. Couldn't wait to do it.
James has said to me before that without slavery, you don't get the Civil War. I can see that kind of. It seems to me that if you don't have slavery, you might still get a push for secession over some other topic later on.
Right.
What's your feel on that? And if so, how would that have been met? I guess the thing I'm grasping for here is some philosophical justification for secession or for denying secession like we had at the founding.
Yeah.
Not finding it, but slavery comes closest. Take that away and what do you have left?
This is what they act on. And the closest historical example that we have outside of slavery, although it's wrapped up in it, is what happens in 1828 to 1832 in the Jackson administration. Tail end of the John Quincy Adams, beginning of the Andrew Jackson administration, and that's the great nullification crisis. It's when South Carolina objected to a tax bill, the Tariff of Abominations in 1828, which came about through a ridiculous set of legislative log rolling and political miscalculation, but nonetheless, we had a really sharp tax hike. The South Carolinians struck it out as basically a very real threat that they would leave the Union if their wish to nullify the law was not acceded to. And of course, Andrew Jackson does what he does best, which is throwing gasoline on a fire and says, okay, fine. If you want to nullify this law, we will meet you with the army in the field, is essentially his message. And make matters even more amusing, you want to talk about a president and a vice president coming at odds and something like the Trump-Pence relationship degrading on January 6th, look at Andrew Jackson and John C. Calhoun as vice president. Jackson wanted Calhoun hanged, and he stated so. And Calhoun probably would have reciprocated.
Looking back on it, we might have been better off.
Right.
John C. Calhoun, not the type of person you want in the halls of government.
The other interesting thing there is both Calhoun and Jackson are pretty radically pro-slavery. Neither of them is a good person on that issue. Quite the contrary. I mean, Calhoun is a pro-slavery theorist. Jackson is something more of a nationalist, but he views slavery as a huge component of that. He wants it to expand. He's a slave owner.
Let me turn the question around a little bit. I spent this past weekend with Rob McDonald and had occasion to ask him all sorts of questions about the founding, about the Civil War. And he said something that had never occurred to me. And I want to get your take on it. He said, up to the point of the Civil War, the Union was doing everything it could to mollify the South.
Yeah.
And so you had the three-fifths compromise and being careful to admit simultaneously slave and free states so you don't tip the balance of power in Congress. And his claim was if the South hadn't declared war, slavery would have just continued.
Even to the point that one of the last attempts at mollification, one of the last conciliatory efforts, the final 2 days of James Buchanan's administration, Congress passed a compromise constitutional amendment. It's called the Corwin Amendment. It stated that slavery should not be interfered with. It said the domestic institutions of the states will not be interfered with. Now, it doesn't pertain to the extension or expansion of slavery, both internally and abroad, which is something the South really wanted. It didn't answer their concerns on enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act, which is another one of their major objections. One of the things that they cite is the reason to secede, but it would have constitutionally enshrined slavery. And even to the point that Lincoln indicated in his first inaugural address, he was willing to go along with this amendment. It was never ratified is the issue because the war breaks out before most states have a chance to even act upon it. But it's one of those great what-ifs of history. Say the South never fires on Fort Sumter, does this amendment get ratified?
And it's interesting because the word slavery appears nowhere in the Constitution. The framers did not use the word. And then if you jump into the amendments, in all of these amendments, right, so 13, 14, 15 in the wake of the Civil War, that changed the relationship between and among the races, slavery is not used in those either.
Right.
Because the inclusion of that one word in any of its permutations would sully the document. It would render the document a simple piece of paper, not the thing that it later became, this thing that we genuflect in front of. it's probably the best governing document, the Constitution, that's ever been created by human minds. Perfect? No. As good as it's ever going to get? Yes, absolutely.
That's an interesting point, and it is by design. They choose their language carefully. It's not that they avoided the term slavery at the Constitutional Convention. We have records of the debates that show the center point of contention at multiple instances. But they are at least conscious and aware that they don't want to insert that into the document because it does at least create something of an opening to eventually get rid of this institution in the mind of those that wanted to abolish it.
In what we might call the official documents of the Revolution and the constitutional period, omitting things like correspondence, slavery is only given a full treatment in one place at one time, and it's in Federalist 54.
Yeah.
That's it. You get a pretty comprehensive treatment of it, but it's short, it's to the point, and then they just move on to other topics. But there's the one place you can go look if you want to see how race was treated.
It would have appeared in the Declaration. It was in Jefferson's original draft.
As a cause against the crown. So it would have been an anti-slavery statement there.
That's right. And it's better than that, because if you look at the indictments against King George that give us the middle part of the Declaration, which nobody ever reads, those indictments go from least important to most important. And the indictment of slavery against the king was last in the list. If you follow the internal logic that Jefferson was working with, this was a really important thing. If you read the top of the document, it says the unanimous declaration of. And in order to get unanimity, they had to cut it out.
Yeah.
There was no unanimity if it addressed slavery in any way.
I want to be a crazy person for a minute.
Wait, hold the phone. You want to be a crazy person for a minute? What have you been in the 15 years I've known you during every minute?
Slavery was clearly this ongoing problem from the founding right up to the Civil War, and the federal government's attempting to balance the issue amongst the states as best it can. We have this series of compromises to not tip the apple cart. And then, of course, all this ends up with the Civil War. And I think about what other topics have we encountered like that? And two stand out in my mind as being the only two I can think of, and that's abortion and gun rights. Those two things, I'm not saying that they rise to the same level of importance as slavery, but I am saying they seem to be of the same type, that there's marked disagreement amongst the states. There's this question of should the federal government have authority to say something on this or should it not? And it seems to be intransigent that the people on the one side will have nothing to do with the other side and vice versa. Do you think it's possible that topics like that, I wouldn't predict a civil war, but could lead us down the similar path that we decide, look, we just need to go our separate ways. And these states are going to go over there and form that country, and these states are going to stay here.
Here's the interesting thing is we've had two major Supreme Court rulings on this in the last month and a half or so, which has upended in some ways many state laws. It's upended federal laws, and it had changed the status quo from where both of these issues had been settled for several decades prior to that. I don't know the easy answer there, and I intentionally try to steer clear of the moral debates that are invoked by these issues. Could nonetheless look at them as someone who studies economics, studies constitutional design, studies political theory. And what we see in abortion in particular, it's a move away from a one-size-fits-all rule at the federal level to a diffused, dispersed federalism approach, which is let the states decide. It's kind of the opposite direction of what was going on in the Civil War era when you had something like the Dred Scott decision. It attempted to impose a national, single, uniform federal standard. I don't want to get into comparing Supreme Court decisions against each other, but Roe versus Wade was certainly a move to nationalize policy on that subject. And what we see in the recent decision, it's going back in the other directions, is diffusing the policy decisions there. I don't know if that serves as kind of a release valve for the issue on the national level, or does it heighten the divide even further by allowing the emergence of states with very different policies side by side simultaneously? The economist in me is inclined to think that it's probably something that decentralizes and diffuses a policy, at least allows for some variation between the states, and that becomes a discovery process in itself to see what works, what satisfies the wants and desires and needs of local communities, while also not trying to impose a one-size-fits-all standard on everybody else. But again, it's a complex issue.
And people should go and read the 10th Amendment, because that should play.
Yeah, Absolutely.
The 10th Amendment has to matter if we have a federal republic.
Could you summarize the 10th Amendment for our listeners?
It's the idea that the Constitution is one of enumerated powers. We find the enumerated powers almost exclusively in Article 1, Section 8, where the authorities of Congress are listed. And anything not listed and not also necessary and proper, which is the
Alexander Hamilton excuse clause.
That's right. Everybody ended up using that clause. But the original design was that if something was not properly dealt with at the federal level, meaning to say not in the list that appears in Article 1, Section 8, then it reverts to the states. If you are pro-life but pro-constitution, you have to admit that there is not a legitimate way nationally to ban abortion, not without constitutional amendment. It reverts to the states. And this used to be an answer that people could live with prior to the progressive era. At this point, people don't even know that amendment exists.
And therein lies the difference with guns. Guns are specifically mentioned that this is not within the purview of the federal government.
You do have a very clear Second Amendment.
One might say that abortion wasn't much of an issue in 1787, but it became one later. Therefore, we are permitted to do all kinds of cartwheels and backflips to turn this into a constitutional issue. No, you don't. If you want to make it a constitutional issue, get yourself an amendment. And that's very, very difficult because the amendment process was inserted in the way it was in order to maintain the status quo.
It's a high bar to meet.
That's right. Wherever we are right now, that's probably where we're going to stay unless things have gotten really out of hand.
I mean, this is the problem when you have courts that go in a very activist direction, whether it's to the left or to the right, or really anywhere in between. And it was the great critique of the Warren Court. Even though the Warren Court probably made some decisions that were morally right or reflective of a need that was not being met, is the mechanism, the way that they went about it, also tended to be a very top-down, heavy-handed, let's read this into the document of the Constitution rather than rule on the basis of the law that we have. And whenever that happens, number one, it's not a good way to entrench something, anything more than the next court coming in and overturning it.
Yep, that's right.
And then the second thing is, it does push other people that are opposed to the outcome into backlash, because they feel they were excluded from the discussion, excluded from the process that reached a sweeping judicial ruling. And that's a peril that has persisted at any time that we've had activist courts in the past. The Dred Scott decision is a result of an activist court. Roger Taney overreaches and states beyond what the Constitution would permit him to try to get a sweeping ruling that's pro-slavery.
Well, let's be clear. He declared that no black person could ever even be a citizen.
Exactly.
It's way beyond pro-slavery.
Yeah. It's at a time when there are black people that had been voting and exercising citizen rights for generations, basically since the founding in some of the northern states.
And fine, I get it. The Warren Court overstepped. I don't know anybody who would say otherwise. They all make the case, and I think very correctly, that the lion's share of those decisions coming out of that court at that time were the morally correct answers. And people confuse what's morally correct with what is constitutionally permissible all the time.
Right.
If you really want an insight into the court, let's go back to abortion for a minute, because with the addition of Sandra Day O'Connor to the court in the Reagan administration, it was largely believed that the minute an abortion case came before the court, she would side with the forces to get rid of abortion. And she didn't do that at all.
Yeah.
An abortion case came up, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. That decision wasn't about abortion nearly as much as it was about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court itself. And Sandra Day O'Connor declared in a very strange opinion, they said that we can't just go back to something because the politics have changed. We have to stick with it or the legitimacy of the court will be upended. The court can't change these things, which is kind of astonishing because it was the court that changed them in the first place.
Right.
Apparently, the court can't change them back. When you look at that, you realize that the stakes at the Supreme Court level are kind of high. And some lunatic like Donald Trump, for all of his failings, and they are legion for they are many, picked a bunch of really interesting Supreme Court justices.
He did. It's almost as if other people were advising that process.
I think that might be right. And then oddly, he took that advice, which is very often not the case. So wrap it all up for us. What am I supposed to think of political self-determination and the possibility of secession? People make this crackpot argument that, yeah, we're going to have another civil war. We're not having another civil war. But something untoward is likely to happen. And I'm wondering what your take on it is.
I tend to think a lot of that rhetoric says, hey, we're more divided than any time in our history. Well, no, because quite a bit of our history, we've been at each other's throats over whatever the issue of the day and the moment happened to be.
Roughly every 30 years.
I'd argue that the more peaceful and settled times are the aberration. They're the deviation from the norm, which is a very heated political climate. So I do tend to discount some of the bombastic rhetoric around that, whether that's coming from the people that are investigating the January 6th events, or on the other side, it's some of the riots that took place in the wake of the George Floyd killing. Yes, these are ugly events that play out, but the media is getting caught up in the moment of the excitement and portraying them as some deviation from a historical norm. At the same time, yes, I can see there are breaking points in some of our political climate, some of the brinksmanship that's being played by both parties. When one party is openly declaring that, hey, they want to pack the Supreme Court because they didn't get their appointments the way that they wanted. This harkens back to only really one other time in our history, and that was in the Roosevelt administration. They tried the same thing. Fortunately, it went down in flames. It turned quite a bit of the tide of popular opinion against Roosevelt. But it does concern me that the move away from some historical norms that have been tried and true practices starts to actually take a foothold. Calls to get rid of the Electoral College, which is often done on a really farcical basis, where they claim that it overrepresents small states and underrepresents large states like California. What they never really tell you is if you look at the small states, they're actually almost evenly divided between red and blue right now. For every Wyoming and South Dakota, there's a Vermont and a Rhode Island to offset it. In many cases, roughly the same population size. So that never really gets entered into the debate the way that it should. And I think, unfortunately, there are people in the academy right now that should know better than some of the arguments that they're making, but they've become partisan activists rather than interpreters of political science and interpreters of the Constitution.
On that dreadful note, I guess we're done here.
Right.
That's all the time we've got this week on Words and Numbers. Be sure to join us next week when Phil won't be here, but we still will, for better or for worse. Until then, follow us on Twitter. Handles are in the show notes. Join the Words and Numbers backstage group on Facebook, where the conversation continues. And for the love of God, will you people just be nice to each other? Just 1 week. Try it a week. I keep asking, and you keep not doing it. But let's give it a shot one time.
I noticed that the past couple episodes, you've just run over my business about email.
That is because I am so sick and tired of this crackpot email. I keep getting email from lunatics because you have invited them into our midst.
Well, if you would like to send hate mail to Phil, please send it to wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
And I'm going to start giving Anthony's personal email address really, really soon, because he kind of deserves it. People should get what they want, good and hard. So there you go.
See you next week. He's not even going to say see you next week. He's just shutting off his equipment.
Yep.
Good night, everyone.